Deadline's Palestinian resistance groups hail an operation in the city of Eilat as a natural reaction to Israeli crimes in the occupied territories. The European Union offers some changes to its proposed ban on Russian oil imports amid growing divisions in the bloc over the issue. And also in our headlines, a British opposition Labour leader says his party has reached a turning point following local elections that saw the ruling Conservatives suffering major losses. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Palestinian resistance movements have praised Thursday's operation in the Israeli city of Eilat that killed three people and wounded four others. The groups say the operation is a consequence of Israel's raids and brutality across the occupied territories. Hamas said the operation represents Palestinians' anger over Israeli attacks on Muslim holy sites and proved that Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line. Islamic Jihad said the Palestinian people will respond to Israeli crimes, and the Palestinian Mujahideen movement said the operation is a natural reaction to Israeli attacks on Al-Aqsa. Israeli police say they've identified two suspects from the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. A manhunt is now underway. Israel has also closed crossings to the West Bank and Gaza Strip. It says the closure will remain in place until Sunday. Political commentator Bruce Katz says Israel, being the occupying regime it is, continuously tramples on the rights and religious beliefs of the subjugated people of Palestine.
Well, my first statement is the simple fact that violence begets violence. And, the Palestinian people have been subject to what I consider to be state-sponsored terrorism for decades. It is inexcusable that Israel has allowed and supported extreme right-wing settlers to basically invade the Al-Aqsa compound, the Al-Aqsa Mosque being the third holiest site in Islam. There's no surprise whatsoever in the fact that there has been a return of violence against Israeli citizens. An occupying force cannot continuously trample on the rights of a subjugated people, trample on their religious beliefs, basically wipe their feet on sacred shrines, and expect that this people will simply lay down and continue to take it without responding.
Day 72 of Russia's military operation in Ukraine. A fresh UN-coordinated effort is underway to evacuate more people from a besieged steel plant in the Russian-held city of Mariupol. A convoy is en route to the city to rescue the last group of civilians from the site as part of the UN's third joint evacuation operation with the Red Cross. An estimated 200 civilians are thought to be trapped inside the Azovstal factory, the last stronghold of Ukrainian forces in Mariupol. Some 500 civilians were evacuated in the two previous phases over the past week. On Thursday, Moscow announced a daytime ceasefire for 3 days to allow civilians to get out of the city, but Ukraine says there's been no pause in fighting at Azovstal. Russia says it has no intention of using nuclear weapons in the Ukraine war. The foreign ministry slams its, quote, deliberate lies. Reports by Western media suggesting the possibility of a nuclear strike by Moscow.
As I have already said, we have repeatedly had to refute insinuations about Russia's possible use of nuclear weapons in the course of its special military operation in Ukraine. This is a deliberate lie. Russia firmly adheres to the principle that there can be no winners in a nuclear war.
Zaitsev said Russia's use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine is ruled out since it's not in line with the objectives of its military operation there. Russia's ambassador to Washington has also reacted to the Western accusation. Anatoly Antonov says such, quote, baseless allegations are part of a propaganda campaign against Russia The diplomat also accused the West of misinterpreting Moscow's recent decision to place its nuclear forces on high alert. He said the move was in response to extremely controversial, or confrontational rather, statements by Western countries that possess nuclear weapons. U.S. officials say Washington provided Ukraine with intelligence that helped its forces hit and sink a Russian missile cruiser. Media reports have quoted the unnamed officials as saying the intelligence was about the location of Moskva, the flagship of Russia's Black Sea Fleet. The officials, however, claimed the United States didn't know Kiev would target the warship with two missiles. Russia earlier said Moskva had gone down while being towed back to port after ammunition on board caught fire. Since Russia began its operation on February the 24th, Ukraine's Western allies, especially Washington, have been ramping up support for the country. Washington is also said to have been providing Ukrainian forces with intelligence about the locations of Russian generals on the battlefield. Moscow says Western military support for Ukraine threatens security of the continent. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban says a proposal by the European Union for imposing sanctions on Russian oil is unacceptable to his country.
Russian or any type of oil can only arrive via pipeline, of which one end is in Russia, the other in Hungary. This is a condition we have. We cannot accept a proposal that ignores this, because this proposal in its current form equals an atomic bomb thrown onto the Hungarian economy.
Still, Orban said Hungary is open to negotiations if its interests are considered in a new EU proposal. The Hungarian Prime Minister also referred to similar sanctions previously imposed by the EU over the war in Ukraine. He said the punitive measures will lead to problems bigger for Europe than Russia. The European Commission proposed a complete ban on Russian oil imports this week. Apart from Hungary, the Czech Republic and Slovakia are also opposed to the embargo. Meanwhile, Brussels has reportedly offered some changes to the embargo to give countries more time to prepare for the move. The Italian government is reportedly considering introducing a new state of emergency linked to the conflict in Ukraine, a looming energy crisis, and the grave deterioration of the country's socioeconomic situation are among the reasons. Max Schuele reports from Rome.
It was March 31st when the Italian government put an end to a two-year state of emergency due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Just over a month later, some Italian media are reporting that the Mario Draghi government is mulling over issuing a new state of emergency linked this time to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Some newspapers have even suggested that Draghi is considering postponing next year's general elections. The Ukraine war and the subsequent sanctions imposed on Moscow, in addition to Rome's decision to significantly cut off its supply of Russian gas, have had a ferocious impact on Italy's already struggling economy.
A government of common sense always works on dealing with more than just one scenario. Suggesting the adoption of war economy and new lockdowns is very much premature. I'd rather focus on diversifying Italy's energy supply sources and tackling unemployment, which is likely to soar significantly in autumn.
The National Association of Entrepreneurs Confindustria has recently said Italy's economy is heading for recession, which is defined by two consecutive quarters of GDP negative growth. Last month, the Italian government revised down its 2022 economic growth forecast to 3.1% from a 4.7% projection made last September, a forecast considered optimistic by most independent bodies. Economists have warned that surging food and energy prices will seriously affect Italian spending power, leading to an excruciating decline in domestic demand. It is also estimated that 500,000 workers are expected to lose their job should Italy completely halt its gas supplies from Russia.
Giving up the Russian supplies will be a catastrophe for the European manufacturer, and for Italy this would be managed only through a profound alteration of the democratic rules.
Last year, Italy had recorded a strong recovery from its economic contraction of nearly 9% in 2020 due to the restrictions adopted to counter the COVID crisis. That recovery has been cancelled by the measures undertaken to sanction Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. Max Civili, Rome.
Results from Thursday's local elections in the UK are coming in, with Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party losing three traditional strongholds in London.
Local Conservatives, 1,680. Dobres, Lizzie, Labour Party, 2,070.
Labour has taken the three councils in Westminster, Barnet and Wandsworth, its leader Keir Starmer says. His party has reached a turning point and is back on track to succeed at the next general elections. Outside London, the Conservatives also lost control of councils in Southampton, Worcester and West Oxfordshire. Meanwhile, the Liberal Democrats have enjoyed good results, gaining 59 councillors. Following the Conservatives' losses, some local council leaders have called on the Prime Minister to resign. They blame the rising cost of living and a number of scandals engulfing the Premier, including lockdown-breaking parties at Downing Street. Johnson has acknowledged it has been a tough night for Conservatives in some parts of the country while enjoying success in other regions. The United States is notorious for imposing sanctions that are blamed for the suffering of ordinary people in several countries. America is sticking to its dangerous policy despite widespread criticism.
The United States is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. That title means a lot of responsibility, as every permanent member is expected to remain committed to global security and collective council action. But the U.S. has shown for decades that it is very much ready to take unilateral measures to get what it wants. A case in point is America's sanctions policy. The U.S. has gone outside the U.N. Security Council mechanism to impose tough unilateral sanctions against many countries. Even close U.S. allies may become a target of American sanctions. This is the Harry S. Truman Building in Washington, D.C. It is the headquarters of the United States Department of State. Many major U.S. economic sanctions programs targeting countries around the world are devised and enforced by politicians, diplomats, and lawyers who work here. From coercion and threats to financial punishment, the team does everything to make sure the sanctions are enforced. Perhaps the harshest sanctions ever imposed by the U.S. have targeted Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and the Russian Federation. America usually defends its sanctions policy, claiming that it is aimed at changing the behavior of foreign governments. But ordinary people in targeted countries have been bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The United States uses the sanctions as a form of hybrid warfare. It is a form of warfare, it's economic warfare, and it's a modern-day version of siege warfare. So you can imagine that the United States, without committing troops on the ground, uses sanctions as a tool in its arsenal for regime change and for pressure campaigns, both politically, militarily, and economically, on countries that do not kowtow to it, do not bow to it, and do not follow Washington's policies.
In Iran, the sanctions have caused economic hardship for people, among other problems. Iranian cancer patients, for instance, have been hit hard by the adverse effects of sanctions. That is because many firms, financial institutions, and banks, which are vital in importing medicine, have been blacklisted by the U.S. State Department.
Iran has been hit by many waves of unilateral American sanctions. The current U.S. administration has failed to fulfill its promise of lifting them. United Nations experts have called the anti-Iran measures unjust and harmful. As we'll see in this next report, Iran's U.N. envoy condemns the imposition of unilateral sanctions on countries, saying they mostly affect ordinary people by preventing access to essential supplies.
Iran has been targeted by some of the harshest American sanctions in decades. Washington refused to give Tehran any relief, even at the height of the coronavirus pandemic, when all countries needed much more financial resources to battle the disease. Although Iran has many years of experience dealing with such economic restrictions, a considerable part of its problems are being blamed on them. They have put a lot of pressure on Iran's economy, causing its currency to lose value and pushing up its rate of inflation to unprecedented levels over the past years. Iran's UN envoy has called on the world body's Department of Global Communications to intensify its efforts to inform the international community about the adverse effects of sanctions on the targeted countries. Addressing a session of the UN's Committee on Information on Wednesday, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations said the use of the coercive economic measures are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, and the UN Charter. Majid Takhtaravanchi noted that the sanctions have undermined economic growth in the target countries and prevent their access to basic medical equipment and materials by blocking their financial resources overseas.
People can't have access to proper medical supplies, food, different types of technologies that are necessary, for example, aviation. You can think of transportation, things like that. Raw materials that are necessary just for basic industry and production. And overall, you see that there is a massive pressure put on the population in terms of their economic power to purchase consumer products because of the sanctions that are imposed. So it puts tremendous pressure on civilian population.
Iran has in the past described American sanctions policy as economic terrorism. Tehran says the U.S. is addicted to such coercive tools. Despite criticism from around the world, the United States does not seem willing to change course anytime soon.
After 2 years of stifling restrictions, the South Korean government has lifted most social distancing limits over COVID-19. As the country sees a decline in cases, South Koreans should still wear masks indoors. But restrictions on gatherings have largely ended to the relief of service industry businesses. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Public outrage is building. The court's approval rating is now around 40%. Congress needs to act before an entire branch of government sinks into an irredeemable Trump-fueled muck of corruption, says Tom Hartman, author, in an article published under the heading, Let's Just Say It Very Clearly. The U.S. Supreme Court is corrupt. Here's the story. So now, as expected after decades of taking big bucks for her right-wing work on behalf of all America's oligarch, we learn that the wife of Supreme Court Associate Justice Clarence Thomas, Jeannie Thomas, was in Trump's January 6 rally up to her eyeballs. Let's just say it right out loud. The Supreme Court of the United States of America is corrupt, and Americans know it very well. No other federal court in the U.S. would allow a defendant in a case before them to fly a judge on a private Gulfstream luxury jet to a luxury hunting retreat in Louisiana and then a week later watch as that judge rules in that defendant's favor. But Supreme Court Justice Antoine Scalia did exactly that when Dick Cheney was sued for allegedly lying about his secret energy group that was planning the seizure and sale of Iraq's oil fields as he and Bush lied Americans into the war that opened those oil fields up to exploitation. No other federal court would allow a judge to give a speech before a group that was funding a case before them and then rule in favor of that group's openly stated goal. But that's exactly when Neil Gorsuch did, when he addressed the Fund for American Studies, itself funded by the Bradley Foundation that was helping fund by Janus versus AFS CME case that gutted union protections for government workers. No other federal court would allow a judge to swear revenge against a particular nonprofit corporation, in this case, the Democratic Party, saying in his confirmation hearing that what goes around comes around, and then rule in cases directly affecting that organization like voting rights. But Brett Bierbong Kavanaugh did just that. No other federal court would allow a judge to rule on a case where he owned $500,000 worth of stock in the company presenting amicus arguments before the court. It's illegal in many states, but John Roberts did just that in ABC versus Aereo case, as did Roberts, Breyer, and Alito in 25 of 37 other cases where they owned stock, according to the Good Government Group Fix the Court. No other federal court would allow a judge's wife to openly interact with and advocate for the interests of dozens of litigants before the court over decades and take nearly $1 million from a group regularly helping bring cases before his court. But Clarence Thomas and his wife have done both, as recently revealed in a shocking New York Times profile. And now the court is on the verge of gutting the EPA, the agency Justice Gorsuch's mother infamously ran into the ground before resigning in disgrace during Reagan administration using Gorsuch's own BS textualist rationale to go after the agency today. In addition, these Republican appointees are openly shooting down Democratic efforts to fight gerrymandered maps while supporting GOP efforts to impose them on states. Is there no way to paraphrase Shakespeare to rid ourselves of this court's corrupt behavior? Turns out Congress has that power, although they haven't used it since Ulysses Grant was president and reorganized the court. Article 3rd of the Constitution establishes the federal court system and gives to Congress itself the power to create the lower federal courts. It also says that the Supreme Court judges may only serve on the court if they behave themselves. It also requires Congress to regulate the Supreme Court. Article 3, Section 2 says the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. The issue of Supreme Court needing regulation from the first among equals legislative branch, Congress, as specified by the founders and framers of the constitutions, has been with us for 121 years. Most people remember William Howard Taft as the one-term progressive Republican president who followed Teddy Roosevelt into the White House in 1909 and was beaten for re-election by Woodrow Wilson in 1912. But after his retirement from the presidency, Taft became the first former president to serve as Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1921. He was the 27th president and 10th Chief Justice of the U.S. In 1921, it came to the attention of the nation and to Chief Justice Taft that U.S. District Judge Landis was taking five times his annual salary as a judge from what was then called organized baseball 5 years after ruling in their favor. The scandal provoked Congress to pass in 1922 a law creating a body that would provide advice and oversight to the federal judiciary. It came to be known as the Judicial Conference of the United States. The scandal also prompted Chief Justice Taft to accept the unpaid chairmanship of the American Bar Association newly formed commission to write ethics rules for federal judges. Taft's commission wrote in 1923 the first canons of judicial ethics, which included 34 categories of judicial conflicts and misbehavior that would either disqualify a judge or require their recusal from cases before them. They included conflicts of interest, personal, financial investments, and even behavior in the courtroom itself. Taft, in delivering the canons, made it clear they should apply to all federal courts, including his own Supreme Court. Within a decade, every state in the Union had adopted the canons for their own courts. The canons, however, had no enforcement mechanism, particularly when it comes to the Supreme Court. After all, who would judge the highest court in the land? That opened the door for literally a century of the Supreme Court ignoring Taft work. The issue came to the fore again in 1969 when Republicans went nuts when it was revealed that Justice Abe Fortas, a very liberal, Republicans call him a communist, LBJ appointee, had taken $15,000 for a summer teaching post, was receiving time-delayed payments from a law former client, and worst of all, was secretly advising President Johnson. Under massive incoming fire from Republicans and their friendly media, Fortas resigned from the Supreme Court on May 14, 1969. Over the next 3 years, the ABA put together a new commission to update Taft's original canon on judicial ethics. That commission released their new code of judicial conduct in 1972, and it was adopted by the Judicial Conference of the United States in 1973. The Supreme Court, however, chose to ignore it, arguing that they were above such considerations. By that time, the Supreme Court had made itself, as we lay out in detail in the hidden history of the Supreme Court and the betrayal of America, the most powerful of the three branches of government, asserting power to second-guess both Congress and the president. Ironically, in his 2011 annual report about the state of the judiciary, Chief Justice John Roberts made lengthy and effusive reference to former Chief Justice Taft and his work with the APA's Commission on Judicial Ethics. His report, however, conveniently omitted the fact that Taft had loudly and publicly asserted it should apply to the Supreme Court. Instead, Roberts noted rhetorically, "Some observers have recently questioned whether the Judicial Conference's Code of Conduct for United States judges should apply to the Supreme Court." We will spare you extended quotes from Roberts' report, which you can read later, but the bottom line is that, in his opinion, the court can tell the 1923 ethics recommendations and the subsequent ones from 1973 to go screw themselves. The Supreme Court, in his mind, is answerable to nobody but itself. As Sam Alito said, "I'm not aware of problems on the Supreme Court itself. We would not sit back. We would take action that's appropriate." Most recently, Senator Chris Murphy introduced the Supreme Court Ethics Act that would seek to regulate the court out-of-control politicking and conflicts of interest. Predictably, it was blocked by Republicans in the Senate. Public outrage is building. The court's approval rating is now around 40%, a historic low. Congress needs to act, requiring them to adopt and conform to the Federal Code of Judicial Ethics at the very least, and expand the court at best, before an entire branch of government sinks into an irredeemable partisan muck of corruption.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَوْ يُوهُ بِلِيهِ اسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Now this year, inshallah, what we're going to be talking about has been called the transition. Today we're beginning, inshallah, with the barzakh. I want to give you a beautiful example from the life of the mother of Amir al-Mu'mini. Because, you know, the mother of an imam is a special person. In Islam, we celebrate motherhood. We celebrate it. If someone has the honor of being a mother, that's something that they should take very seriously. How do I become a better parent? Right? What about the mother of an imam? And you and I, alhamdulillah, Allah gave us tawfiq, talked a little bit about her spiritual station with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now we want to learn again from the mother of Amir al-Mu'mineen. So this is actually the story I want to tell you is about her death. Imam Ali came running to the Prophet. He came to the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and he was crying. The Prophet said, "What happened?" He said that my mother passed. And the Prophet said, "Rather, my mother passed." She was that close to the Prophet. The Prophet shared a few words over there about how she used to take care of the Prophet before she would take care of her own children. So devoted to the cause. The Prophet then went to take care of her burial process. And the people, when they saw this, they were a little surprised at the actions of the Prophet. One of the things that the Prophet did was that he gave the instructions, and so The burial process was carried out under his orders. I'll give you examples. He gave some of his clothing, like cloth that had been on his body, to be part of her burial shroud. He walked, and they said that when the prophet was walking in the burial procession as they're carrying her, when the prophet was walking, he was walking very slowly, and he would lift one foot and then put another foot down. Lift, right? Walking really, really slowly. When they got over there, the prophet went to her the grave that they had dug for her. He laid down in her grave. They brought her into the grave. The prophet did the talqeen. When we tell the person, what were your beliefs? And the prophet did the talqeen. So after that, alhamdulillah, everything was done and people were now leaving. One more thing that the prophet did. They said that when he led the prayers, he did the takbir 70 times. And then after that, everybody was ready to leave. When everybody was ready to leave, the prophet said something that shocked everyone. He said this sentence. He says, Ibnuk, la Ja'far wa la Aqil. Your son, not Ja'far and not Aqil. Ibnuk Ali ibn Abi Talib. Your son Ali ibn Abi Talib. So what happened was, the people were shocked. So they came to the prophet afterwards. They said, what just happened? The way that we saw this wasn't normal. So the prophet started to explain. He said that the reason that I was walking so slowly was because there were so many of the angels, the malaika. There were so many malaika. I was walking slowly because there's so many malaika gathered there. Why did you say 70 takbir? He said, I said it 70 times because there were 70 long rows of the malaika. They said, what about the burial shroud? That was from you. You gave the burial shroud. He says that when she was alive, I talked to her about the grave. And when I talked to her about the grave and I mentioned that there's this squeeze in the grave, he says that she was very terrified. So I went and I laid down in the grave that inshallah Allah take that away from her. But what about when you, because you didn't only do that, you performed the talqeen afterwards. You said those words. And this is the part I was talking about. He says that when the angels came in and they started asking her about her beliefs, she would answer correctly. So man rabbuk, who's your Lord? Allah. Who's your prophet? She named the prophet. Then the angels asked, who is your imam and your wali? He said, at that stage, she was ashamed to tell Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I raised Imam Ali. She didn't consider, this is the status of the awliya of Allah. Everything they've done, they consider nothing. Now for her, she found it difficult to go over and say that, my son, Ali. So at this stage, when the prophet saw this was the situation, he said, I told her, no, you say it. That's your son. It's okay. You say it. The prophet over there speaking. And at this stage, he says that Allah granted her a lot of peace and comfort. So the believer, brothers and sisters, stays motivated, stays pushing, never feels I have enough. Even if it's someone at the station of being the mother of Imam Ali, she also feels, well, what do I have and what have I done? So this kind of an attitude makes us not only stay motivated, we seize the moment. This is good for us as youth. Instead of us procrastinating, delaying, maybe one day, we take advantage of the time that we're in. I'll give you another example. This is from the words of Imam Ali. He says this, إِنَّمَا أَنْتَ عَدَدُ أَيَّامٍ. He says that you're only the sum of your days. He says, with each day that passes, part of you goes. With that kind of an approach, the idea that time is getting shorter, the believer stays motivated. And we've never been promised. It's never the case that Islam says, well, you and I, we've definitely been guaranteed you're going to live for 70 years. You're going to live for 100 years. No, sometimes, as Imam Sadiq says, death comes instantaneously. No warning signs. No. You and I remember our friend, our brother, Yusuf Shami. If anyone, who is the biggest and strongest of us? For many of us, if we go to the grave now and we read the date, some of us are older than he is. We don't know. We've never been told. So what that does is it makes us prepare. Once they ask Ayatollah Marhum Mirza Shirazi, the person who made the fatwa for tobacco, they said, what if somebody came to you and told you, and you had yaqeen, and you were sure they're telling the truth, that you only have 1 week to live, what would you do? He said, I would do exactly what I've been doing up until now. He'd been prepared. He's living, this is my last, I'm only a number of days. What does God want from me? Trying his best. So for us, that's our approach. The idea is in Islam to prepare, not to wait till one's 90 years old and then figure it out. No, now. The idea is now.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
We are seeing injuries we didn't see before. Pelvic fractures, spinal cord injuries, brain injuries, and a lot of open fractures when the bone comes through the skin, said a San Diego doctor. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading Absolutely Tragic, Doctors Tie Trump's 30-foot border wall to surge in injuries and deaths. Here's the story. Doctors in Southern California are connecting former President Donald Trump's efforts to build a U.S.-Mexico border wall that can't be climbed, with soaring rates of serious injuries and death among migrants. Seven physicians at the University of California, San Diego, detailed new statistics and their observations about local trauma cases in a research letter published recently in the journal JAMA Surgery. Under Trump, a 30-foot wall was installed across more than 400 miles, often replacing shorter barriers. The doctors focused on admissions to their trauma center after the new wall went up in California's Imperial and San Diego counties. Before the higher barrier was built, there were 67 fall admissions from the border wall compared with 375 during and after the period. The letter states, explaining that this increase of more than five times is still significant when doctors factor in average apprehensions by U.S. immigration officials. After the wall was raised, there was also a jump in depth from 0 to 16. Once you go over 20 feet and up to 30 feet, the chance of severe injury and death are higher. Dr. Jay Dossett, chief of the trauma division at UC San Diego Health, told the Washington Post, adding, "We are seeing injuries we didn't see before, pelvic fractures, spinal cord injuries, brain fractures, and a lot of open fractures when the bone comes through the skin." As the newspaper reported, at Scripps Mercy Hospital, the other major trauma center for the San Diego area, border wall fall victims accounted for 16% of the 230 patients treated last month, a higher share than gunshot and stabbing cases, according to Vishal Bansal, the director of trauma. Bansal said in an interview, "I've never seen anything like this. This is crazy." His trauma ward treated 139 border wall patients injured by falls last year, up from 41 in 2020. Hector Almeida, a 33-year-old dentist from Cuba, who was sent to UC San Diego Health after fracturing his left leg, told the Post that, "I never expected we would have to climb the wall." According to the paper, smugglers let his group to the wall with a ladder and told them to climb up and slide down the other side, said Almeida, who said he saw one woman fall and break both legs and an older man with a severe head injury. The San Diego Union-Tribune shared what happened to a Mexican family trying to flee drug cartel violence after they were turned away by U.S. officials under the Title 42 policy while seeking asylum at the San Diego port of entry. On a foggy night in mid-March, several family members from the Mexican state of Michoacán followed the smugglers' instructions to climb the first of the two border barriers to reach U.S. soil near San Diego. One of the women felt her grip slipping on the first fence from the moisture in the air as she struggled over. When she approached the second wall looming 30 feet above her, she realized it would be impossible for her to get over safely. As she panicked, the smugglers told her to wait to the side for Border Patrol to get her so that other migrants could cross. It was only after she reached the Border Patrol station that she learned that her 14-year-old daughter, whom the smugglers sent with an earlier group, had fallen from the 30-foot wall. The woman said, "It was the worst night of my life." The woman, whose daughter remains mostly bedridden after spending a week in the hospital with a fractured skull, neck, and back, added, "We had come to save our lives, not to risk them in such an awful way." Along with the human impact, the rise in falls has taken a financial toll. The letter notes that the increased hospital cost of the surge in admissions exceeded $13 million in 2021 dollars. The surge also coincided with the COVID-19 pandemic, which has strained the U.S. healthcare system, the paper points out, adding, "The care of these injured immigrants is not only a humanitarian problem, but also a public health crisis that further worsened trauma center bed capacity, staff shortages, and professionals' moral injury. Most of these patients had significant brain and facial injuries or complex fractures of the extremities or spine, with many requiring intensive care and staged operative reconstructions. Lack of health insurance made most patients ineligible for rehabilitation facilities or post-discharge physical therapy, further lengthening prolonged hospital stays." The letter says that the Title 42 policy, enabling U.S. officials to swiftly expel many migrants like the family from Mekonnen, may have increased the numbers and desperation of persons crossing the border away from ports of entry and increased the number of falls. The Title 42 policy was implemented under Trump and continued under Biden, who plans to end it next month, though some lawmakers are pushing to extend it with a bill that critics say ignores individuals and families in desperate need of safety and the right to seek protection from persecution.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. The economy's resilience is a big success. Additionally, we benefited from the sanctions. Our nation, our officials, and our managers took advantage of the sanctions in many cases to achieve self-sufficiency. If we had not been under sanctions, for instance, when the coronavirus emerged, we would have improved vaccines from different countries in the world, and we would not have thought of producing it on our own. As Mr. President stated, vaccines are being produced in 5-6 centers. This is a source of pride for the Iranian nation. It is an honor for the Iranian nation. Of course, we benefited from other countries' vaccines because we should have done so, and there was nothing wrong with it. But the fact that we ourselves managed to take action is an achievement in itself. In numerous areas, we achieved self-sufficiency and creativity. On television, we see many cases in which 4-5 youth gather together and produce something. They create a financially valuable thing, and the quality of that product is better than the foreign counterparts. These things are broadcast, and everyone can witness them. We are seeing these things. These are a nation's success and progress. These achievements happened in the economic area.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the very area of the economy, despite the sanctions and harsh measurements, the country did not run up debts. If you look at many countries, neighboring and non-neighboring countries, despite the fact that they were not under any sanctions and that they did not confront so much enmity, they went into a debt of $300-400 billion to the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and such a country. Our debt is close to zero. It is not zero, but it is close to it. This is not a minor achievement. Rather, it is very important. That is, even in the area of the economy where there are many negative indicators, there are such positive indicators as well. Another achievement of ours, which is an indicator in itself and which must receive due attention, is our scientific, industrial, and technological progress. At a time when we were under international pressures of all sorts, we managed to progress in various scientific and industrial areas. This is not a minor achievement. Rather, it is very important.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.